Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, the Fantastic Voyage. I am the captain of this vessel on the road again with the Milwaukee Bucks, Marcus Johnson, joined by my son, Chris Johnson, the only father and son duo to win a national championship at the same school, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that as the broadcast goes on and as the season goes on. Chris, how you living? How are things going?
Oh, I'm doing good, MJ. Bucks got a win. Feeling good out here. If the people want to listen to us, find us, you can subscribe to the Bucks official YouTube channel. Leave us a like or a comment there, or subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah. Please do that and leave us those likes and check us out because, man, things are heating up. Things are heating up come winter time. After this segment, don't go anywhere. We got a great, great interview coming up in the next segment, Shea Serrano. Now, you talk about a guy who has accomplished a lot as a writer. He's had 4 New York Times bestsellers. Barack Obama.
Sheesh.
Barack Sheesh. Obama. He was on his list. It's one of his favorite authors, and he's got a new book that's out now called Expensive Basketball. So we'll have a chance to talk to Shea Serrano about that. But first, man, got a game in the books, season opener, a lot of things going on, playing against a pesky Wizards team, Chris Middleton coming back in town. But yeah. Chris, watching that game, the way this team jumped out of the gate.
Right.
How'd you feel watching this team jumping out of the gate, the way they were playing, the way they were passing, the way they were shooting?
Well, I think it was a testament to the offseason preparation and the mentality instilled in these guys by Doc Rivers. I mean, that level of defensive aggression, the sharing the sugar aspect, the ball moving, but the aggressiveness. I mean, you saw the videos in practice with Giannis. That kind of told me a lot. He was saying something to Bobby, him and Bobby getting into it. But what that told me, the Bucks were going to come out, well, as you would say, frothing at the mouth, right? Yeah. Like trying to really set the tone. I think Chris being in the building had a little bit to do with that. I think this is the Wizards. Let's keep it absolutely 100 about level setting as far as expectations. But what you were impressed by was the team unity, the cohesiveness between the guys already. It looked spotty at times, obviously, but from this year to last year, man, I feel like there's just a level of pace that you're seeing that's a lot different. Stuff we talked about all summer, MJ, and stuff that I heard you mentioning on the broadcast, but the 3-point rate, getting up the threes. And Eric Name posted some stuff to Twitter and just, you know, great stat about how, you know, the Bucks, I don't want to quote the stat, but basically they're getting up a lot more threes at a lot heavier rate, which is something you love to see. And then defensively, MJ, then I'll let you go in on it. I just like the versatility. And the athleticism. I mean, it's a feel. It's a feel when you watch that game last night that you just haven't had as far as on the defensive side, just their capabilities, you know, and to be able to sustain it, right? Those lows that took place that you saw, but then, you know, guy, you still had legs. You were talking about on the broadcast about these legs, these young legs.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me.
Yeah. And some great points, but, to expound on Eric Name, I mean, this team shot, I believe, 28 three-point field goal attempts in that first half, knocked down 13 of those, so that's like 46%. Chris, 56% of those field goal attempts in that first half were corner threes, and that's an inordinate amount of corner threes, which means a couple of things. Transition, the Bucks' transition frequency in that first half, 27%. Plus, which is like the 98th percentile, and then live ball rebounds, they got out on 50% of the live ball rebounds. They got out in transition. That's young legs, babe. They were nowhere near that number last year. And that first game against the Raptors, man, they just really did some good things. And especially as you talked about sharing the sugar. Remind me of Steve Lavin saying, I've got to share the sugar.
But That's where I got it.
We got to share the sugar. But sharing the sugar, the one more pass, that one more.
Going from a
really good shot, A.J. Green, a really good open look, a Gary Trent Jr., a really good open look, to a KPJ in the corner, or A.J., you know, out top, or whatever it was. But they shared the basketball in terms of creating great looks, as opposed to, and I'm not just going to say good looks, really good looks by really good shooters. And that mindset, I think, will carry them a long way. So I'm like you. I was impressed with a whole lot of things going on, especially. And so Kevin Porter Jr., he turns his ankle, plays under 10 minutes. But I was looking, Chris, at his net rating when he was on the floor. And again, it's a small sample size, so it's skewed, you know. But his net rating was like 68.2. 150 on the offensive end, 82 on the defensive end.
And again, MJ, you know, it is – I mean, look, I like the Wizards young crew, the George, Keyshawn George coming in there, you know, doing some things.
And, Bub Carrington.
Bub Carrington and those guys.
Cam Whitmore.
Who is live, who is extremely live. And Sar, your boy Sar. I mean, he second half last year averaged over 15 points a game, had a great second half to his rookie season, you know, made some highlight reel blocks, throwing Bobby stuff, just living above the rim. But the reality is, it felt like the Bucks were in a different class than that crew yesterday.
And
that's what I saw. I think that's exciting.
Yeah, no, it is. And to touch on that point, you know, I was kind of communicating with my guy Sam Presti yesterday, a little bit back and forth, just talking about Will Dawkins, the general manager of the Wiz, and some of the people they've got. Brian Keefe was on his staff at OKC when Sam was down there. All these guys have been with Sam 7-10 years, and that's kind of that Popovich. But get the veterans, Chris Middleton, CJ McCollum, and Sam Presti talked about, it's a stabilizing impact that it has on the team, and then that leads to better player development. But you could see when this team got down, they didn't quit. And to me, that's those veterans kind of stabilizing us. Okay, you know, we got to just withstand this first punch in the mouth, and now it's time for us to hit them back. And they hit the Bucks back. But to the Bucks' credit, they respond once they were punched back. And that hasn't always been the case, man.
Well, they had the wind and the legs to respond, MJ. They had the bodies. That's just what it's going to come down to every single time. Yeah. No matter how much we wanted these guys to be certain type of dudes, they just age, father time, man. It's not possible. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, Bobby Portis says the Bucks have. It's funny when we had Bobby on the podcast, and I alluded to this in the game with Lisa Byington. You know, when I was talking about the Bucks are 12 deep, Bobby's like, hey, he corrected me. No, I feel like we, you know, 13, 14 quality players deep. And Doc Rivers had some interesting things to say about this depth, the quality depth, but then the level of competitiveness that it provides. Yeah. That's one aspect that people don't think about. When you got that kind of quality depth, these two units, man, they go at each other, man. And they went at each other in training camp. Doc Rivers talked about that.
One of the most competitive preseasons I think I've ever had as a coach. I've seen a lot. And I thought a lot of things were at play. They obviously know that Giannis and Miles and those guys on the first unit, but they didn't care. And I love that. I love the fact that there were arguments, you know, guys wouldn't give in to each other. And we talked about it every day.
Yeah. And so we saw that play out last night. And as it would happen, we talked about KPJ and the ankle sprain. And so now all of a sudden, you know, either a Cole Anthony or a Ryan Rollins has got to be thrown. Now, let me say this about Ryan Rollins. And I want your take on this too, Chris.
Okay.
To start that third quarter, it was about 5 straight possessions when the Bucks didn't score.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Rollins was starting as the point guard, along with the regular starters. I thought he got sped up. They pressured him up that right sideline, and as opposed to him beating the pressure and then pulling it back out and now getting the Bucks into their sets, into their offense, I thought he was a little too aggressive looking for his own. He got caught in the key one time when Keyshawn George kind of stripped him when he made a spin move. Gary Trent Jr. was open on that left break line. Maybe should have circled maybe toward the middle to present himself a little clearer to Ryan. And then Ryan came down the next time. He beat the pressure, but then he pulled up for that elbow. It's like, you know, to me, you got to have a better feel for the game. You got to read the game. Like, read the room. You got to read the game. I thought he... At that moment, now this is a part of his growth. It's criticism, but it's a part of his growth process. He's got to read the game and the flow of the game. If Giannis ain't touched the basketball, Chris, in 4 or 5 possessions, you as the point guard, it's incumbent upon you to make sure that you feed the big fella on those on these next four or five possessions.
Yeah, but you know, this guy is still growing, MJ. He's still evolving, and as you alluded to, right? So like that's a growing pain, you know, understanding when to go, when not to go. Let's not forget, he's with Cole and KPJ. I'm curious to see how many reps he's actually been getting with yeah. the first unit and the point guard. So he's locked into second unit reps.
As a shooting guard, almost. Yeah.
And so now muscle memory, I get out here. It's like, you know, yeah. And again, I always say, you know, I don't see players. I see objects. So it's not no more. There's Giannis, there's Miles, and there's this. I see dudes and I'm trying to get to the rim.
Yeah.
And look, I know it sounds weird, but I think it's just like, it's how players continue to get better. He's not a finished product. He's 22 years old
yeah.
or 23, 23 or whatever. So like, this is what 22-year-olds go through. They go through these little moments where you got to have some down times and you got to go back, sit down, look at the film, doc talk to you. Okay, we got five possessions, you know, queued up for you. Here's what you could have did differently.
Right.
Talk just like you just talked to him, MJ. And that's part of the growing process. But what you do get from a Rollins, man, it's just a level as a, somebody that's watching. I mean, there's a level of comfort there, especially on the defensive end, man. I just feel like this guy, when he starts harassing and he starts to bother you and check your handle and reach and slide and dip and go for the ball, man, I mean, he was doing that, but he was sustaining that. And it carries over into every other defender. It kind of pumps everybody else up on the defensive side.
Yeah, it didn't have a good game for Ryan, but still
sure.
Three steals, three assists,
hey,
29, yeah. Just under 30 minutes. So look, Chris, and this is something that I know you'll appreciate. So after that game against Toronto, Ryan struggled, you know, missed 7 of his 9 shots, 5 of his 6 three-point shots. I take care of my never-ending post-game duties. I'm just being facetious. I love working with Craig and Sean. We have a good time on the set. But we did the post-game. Getting ready to leave out of the arena, head back to the kitchen area near the locker room to get my post-game grub to take back to my crib and kind of chill out. And who do I see on the floor with that compression shirt on, getting up his 250 made jumpers after every home game? It's Ryan Rollins, man. And it just warms my heart. He was doing it last year, and he's continued that resiliency, that commitment, that discipline.
Oh, yeah.
And you and I, we always talk about that. I mean, you know, it's the guys that are disciplined to work on their games when others are showering and getting out of there and doing whatever they're doing going into the night. He's out there, man, and not because he missed some shots that he thought he could have made, but this is just a part of his process.
You gotta go above and beyond, man, if you want to be the greatness. It's the Kobe Bryant system, right?
Yeah.
Period. That's what I always go back to. If you're really on that psycho, you're going to work out, do some stuff after every game. You're
yeah.
not tripping. You're not treating this like nothing except I need to shoot it.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. I'm working on my game. So,
please.
And speaking of which, maybe the poster boy for working on his game, Giannis. Now, so I'm looking at his usage. What would you think his usage was? If you haven't seen it, have you seen his usage?
I haven't seen it. So,
what do you think his usage was for that game one against the Raptors?
Because I mean, I would guess, you know, but I'm thinking the minutes, right? And so I'm like, is usage in the minutes?
27. It's the touches.
This usage it's formula is minutes associated with usage?
Not really.
Not really? Okay.
But if you get a lot done in a minimum amount of minutes, then that kind of says that you.
So was his usage 35?
45.3, bro.
Jeez, I was going to say 40. That's one of the highest usages I've ever heard of. I've never even seen that.
45.3. And so here's what I like.
That's
he took
crazy.
19 shots in the second half, something crazy. But you know, he didn't force things in the first half. The Bucks came out torrid, man, in terms of shooting the basketball, knocked down 9 of their first 12 shots.
Yeah, they were in the flow state.
In serious flow state. And so Giannis, and the way the Wizards were playing Giannis, they were sending that extra defender at him. You know, every time he catched, there was a guy right there.
Taking his rhythm.
Yeah, busting his rhythm
break.
All up.
Which
is a great coaching strategy. And
right.
I wouldn't be surprised, and we're going to talk about this guy in a minute, if Chris Middleton in the coaches meeting and said, Chris, what do you think? How should we play Giannis?
100%.
Break up his rhythm, you know, early. Don't let him get started early. because he done dropped 50 on you Wizards. He's averaging like 40 a game or something on the Wizards.
Yeah, I saw the stat.
Something crazy.
I saw the stat.
So to Giannis's credit, he's distributing. He's giving it up early. He's had some hockey assists, the swing. And so I like that mindset. But when it came time to total and utter and sheer determination and domination, the big fella, Chris, came with it. Every time the Wizards would get close, 7 points, they get within, playing well. The veterans leading them, Chris Middleton leading them. Giannis at that elbow. But again, a lot of it was just good job getting into the offense, but ball movement. I thought when the Bucks kind of got stymied offensively, went about 4 minutes without scoring, it was like one and done. You know, first guy get it, take a shot. First guy get it, try to be aggressive, get to the hole.
Yeah. No, man, but again, that's why this Bucks lineup, this Bucks team to me is so dangerous. Because you can win the non-Giannis minutes, and then when Giannis gets in the game, we can go into overdrive. And so, like, you know, I've been saying it, you know, since the summer, just I was very bullish, or not bullish, but I was, like, high on this team, man. I didn't understand how people viewed them as a team that, like everybody, a 5 seed to a 13 seed. After one game, it's the Wizards, man, but more so the style of play.
Yeah.
And just the reality of our depth. That's not like something like last year. It's like, could these guys do it? No, we got depth. Those guys can play the minutes and they can be effective on the NBA level. The system is yesterday was our first sample, but man, that stuff looked good, man. Well, I don't want to get too hype, MJ, but god dang. Yeah. They came out like it looked good.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. But have you ever started out a year where you guys were playing great from game one and then kind of hit a lull somewhere along there. How hard is it to sustain this type of level in terms of connectivity, sharing the sugar, you know, before dudes start tripping and start thinking about not sharing the sugar?
You're saying in the context of losing some games or just...
Well, no, just in the context of like, if this, let's just take this Bucks team, right? This game one. This style of basketball that we saw.
Right.
It's like a team that was not, mid-season form, if you will. They were already connected. This is what coaches kind of coach to build up to.
Right.
You know, usually you don't start the season with this level of offensive connectivity unless you're like the Warriors and these other guys, right?
Right.
Established units, established squads. Did you play on a team or have you had that experience in the NBA where you guys started out like that connectivity? You might have went through a lull later on. How hard is it, I guess, is my question, to maintain that level of connectivity in the NBA over the course of 82 games?
Well, and so this is where culture comes into play. And so I can give you a couple of examples. I think my second or third year with the Bucks, we started out, maybe my third year, winning a bunch of games in a row on a high and then came down, but had enough culture already established after 3 years with Don Nelson and Junior Bridgman and Quinn Buckner and myself. We've got Bob Annier at the trade deadline and Brian Winters. I mean, so these Sidney Moncrief, you know, Hall of Famer. So we had that culture. Now, when I played with the Clippers, I don't know if you remember this one season, we started out 5-0.
Yeah, I do.
We were undefeated, man. But then reality started to set in, but that culture was different. So now after you lose two or three in a row, the first thing you start thinking about is, here we go. Okay, it's back to reality. It's back to our normal selves. This was a dream. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. I mean, it was kind of that thing going on with us, man. You know, it was all a dream. 5-0 was all a dream. And then we struggled from that point on out. Now, with this team, I think with Doc Rivers and his championship pedigree with Darvin Ham and the Dave Yeager and the guys that have been head coaches and know how to manage a team during the ups and downs, I think this team will be okay. But you know, this early part of the season when you've got the Raptor team that shocked the Atlanta Hawks and beat them by 20 on opening night. You got the Cavs that are smarting from an early season loss to the Knicks. We got the Knicks coming into Milwaukee. You know, the Golden State
Warriors. It's some hitters.
The Golden State
hitters.
Warriors coming in.
It's some
after
hitters.
That. I mean, so we'll see.
We
will
see.
This is where you got to really bring it. So, and I expect them to bring it. So we'll see. But I tell you, one of my favorite moments last night, obviously, was the return of Double Deuces, Cash Money Middleton, number 22. And I had a chance, Chris, to corner him before the game after he'd done his pregame shooting. And a lot of people were talking to him. And you know how you kind of watch a guy and you see when you can get your moment. And I saw my moment.
You're stalking.
I was really stalking my guy. And so I said, Chris, stopped him, and he was cool. You know, we got a really good relationship. And so I said, man, I got to tell you a quick story. When I first got here, it was like his second or third year, 11 years ago. And Tim Gergovich, the great coach who I knew from my days working with the Seattle Sonics, as he was George Karl's assistant, long time Tark assistant at UNLV, but just a basketball lifer, great guy. But Gerg was Chris's guy. You know, he was responsible for Chris's development. So Gerg asked me, he called me coach, Coach, do you think you can talk to Chris? I was like, well, talk to him about what, Gerg? And I'm telling Chris this story. I just think if he had some confidence, more confidence, he could really develop into a really good player in this league. I was like, okay, well, let me watch him. So I watched him, Chris, for about a week. I saw how competitive he was. I saw the trash talking he was getting into in practice. I saw the almost fights he was getting into with Giannis. Those two were going at it tooth and nail in practice. And I went back to Gerg, and I was like, Gerg, this guy has got you conned, man. He's got you thinking he's this Southern gentleman, real nice guy, manners, yes sir, no sir, yes coach. I said, this dude's a killer, man.
He's like a dog.
I said, this dude, he's a dog. He's a killer. I said, he's a killer. I told Chris that story, and he just laughed. But man, it was so great, man, having him come back to Milwaukee. The reception. What did you think about that reception? What, the four different standing ovations in the course of the evening?
Well, not only that, which was amazing and a testament to why the Bucks fans are arguably the greatest fans in all of sports, but it's more about the homecoming festivities that kind of blow you away about it. It really shows you how truly loved and valued this guy is. Like, it's not fake. Like, some people, some teams, that guys that leave teams, you think, you know, is this stuff really genuine? I think with Middleton, watching him talk to Giannis and Thanasis on the Thanalysis podcast episode where they had Chris via Zoom, you saw the kind of just the emotion, the bittersweet sort of sentiment, kind of like, you know, I wish you guys wouldn't have traded me. I'm not saying he said anything that remotely associated with that.
I feel that every time I'm around him, Chris. I feel it too.
And just listening to him, so it takes you to a place where you kind of view it through a lens a little differently. Like, for me, I never understood why Bucks fans just unilaterally hated Kuz. Like, unilaterally hated Kuz. It's not about Kuz.
Yeah.
It's what Kuz represents.
Yeah,
and it's,
man,
their guy, their hero. We traded you for Chris Cash.
Right.
Like, so it's a big deal. So you just, man, all that to be said, man, yes, emotional time, emotional moment. I mean, I love the competitiveness in the game. It's just something you don't see nowadays in the aspect where this was like genuine as it gets.
Yeah.
Like, I'd never seen anything so genuine for a guy coming back. Maybe it's happened in other sports, but, and I can remember a lot of NBA stuff like this. I'd never seen anything so genuine and loving and coming from a place of, you know, real just sincerity, if you will.
Yeah. And see, so my situation was the anti-Kuz, because I got traded for Terry Cummings, and Terry, you know, was averaging about 25 a game with the Bucks, and I came back here, and he was like just flourishing, and so I had some questions.
Wait, so when you came back with the Clippers?
When I came back with the Clippers to play the Bucks, Terry Cummings, you know, he was already good, already a great player, but he was playing just at the top of about 24 points a game,
MJ?
You know. But so I'm, you know, my thing is like, when they introduce me, will the fans be like the baseline bums down in San Antonio and be like, yeah, good riddance, so who cares? So what? You know, but they gave me a rousing round of applause and kind of a standing ovation, if I remember correctly. Not quite like Chris, but it was heartfelt. Now, go ahead.
Oh, staying on that, do you think if you would have won a championship, do you think your
yes
ovation would have been a lot bigger?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
My knee-jerk reaction is yes, but when you just made a comment, Chris, and I, you know, people might think it's all cap when you said these Bucks fans are some of the greatest in the country. But this fan base appreciates you
100%
for giving a complete effort, giving all you could give. Whatever you're going through, the problems you might have, the personal issues, you're out there trying as hard as you can. And I think they appreciated our teams in the 80s for that, despite the and our fans in Milwaukee are realistic. It's like, hey, if we'd have lost to the New Jersey Nets with Albert King and Darwin Cook, you know, and that crew, or the Knicks with Michael Raver, you know, we'd have lost a lesser opponent, then it's different. We lose to the Sixers with Moses Malone, you know, 4-5-4. We lose to Larry Bird and the Celtics with the Chief and Kevin McHale and Dennis Johnson and that crew. So our fans are realistic about the expectations. Much like, it's funny because I still feel this sense of outpouring and love for the Brewers and the kind of season they got swept by the Dodgers. But the fans are still appreciative of them, you know, giving it everything they got, playing as hard as they can, and they came up short, so what? But to your point, Chris Middleton, he made a couple of observations just in line with what you were talking about being traded and kind of, you know, why'd you guys trade me that? But he talked about when you spend so many years, especially the formative years, like he spent in Milwaukee, when you get traded like that, it feels like you left a piece of yourself in that city. Mm. And that's how he feels with Milwaukee. He's left a piece of himself. And then he said he was talking to his mom that morning of the game, and he told her with everything that was planned, the video, the this, the that, and all the tributes, that it kind of feels like you're going to your own funeral. And but then he made the point about, you know, but
why is that so funny?
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's profound, it's deep. And when you think about it, I mean, you know, but he said that he feels fortunate and he's grateful that he gets his flowers while he's still around to appreciate them. But just the tributes, you know, the eulogy and this game and all that. But it couldn't happen to a better guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to put a cap on it, I mean, it's like this thing with this relationship that the fan bases have with these players. It's like sometimes you just, I don't know, you just don't really realize the impact that a guy really has on a fan base until he gets traded. Like, so to see all this and all the standing ovations, I've never seen a quartet of standing ovations for one guy. It just makes you think like, man, as much as Chris misses this, a piece of him is here. It's really the Bucks fan feel like a piece of them or a piece of their, you know, Bucks fandom. No, it's like, but it's
memories, emotions.
It's real.
Emotions.
It's not Hollywood.
Game winners, 40 piece against the Hawks when Giannis is out. No, that this is me as the broadcaster.
It's in here. It's in here.
Yeah.
It's in here.
Yeah, no, without question. So that brings me to this, and we'll kind of wind up this segment with this. And Peter Fagan, the Bucks president, Mike called me on the carpet for this conversation, getting it initiated. But do we need?
Wait! Don't say nothing. Man, we talk about Peter Fagan, dog. Don't be trying to make no comments on here. You talk. He gonna get on you for this conversation.
No. I've been.
Oh, you just playing? I always
joke with Peter like that.
Oh, okay, my bad.
Because it'll be some expense involved in it. Is my point. You know, he's the guy that kind of watches the nickels and dimes and all that.
Yes, sir.
But they've gone. They haven't spared any. We're paying Dame literally what $25 million a year of dead money. So you know, this team has shown that they'll go to whatever extreme they need to go to put the best product on the floor. But here's the thing: statues. There's a few other teams that have statues. The Heat with D. Wade. Lakers got all their great Shaq and Kobe and Kareem and that whole crew, Jerry West. The Jazz. Yeah. Did you know the Jazz had the Stockton and Malone statues?
I didn't realize it, but, you know, those guys deserve that. But I didn't
realize
it.
I didn't either. They deserve it. The Mavs. Dirk.
That's sick. The Dirk. Is the Dirk statue a one-legger?
It's probably a one-legged fadeaway. And then the Bulls, of course, with MJ. Would you like to see statues in the Deer District in Milwaukee? And who would be the three or four players that would warrant having statues? Would Chris Middleton rate for a statue? Yeah.
This is a great convo. I mean, this definitely needs to be something that we get a lot of mileage of on social media. For the next week.
Does my Chris question, Middleton deserve a statue?
My question is, as I do with all this type of stuff, what is the criteria? What is the criteria? We got to establish the criteria for getting a statue. Because as much as you want to give Kareem one, right?
Yeah.
How many years was he a Buck? And it comes up in these discussions about the greatest Buck of all time and how, you know, sort of, you know, Giannis is kind of like, you know, is unequivocally the one. So let's start statue deservers. Does the Big O deserve a statue? Does Giannis? Does Kareem? Does, I don't know if Chris, do you, does Sidney, does anybody from the Bucks of those 80s teams deserve a statue? We got to set up the criteria, man.
Well, like, so here's what I would say, and this is going to leave me out, but it's okay. I would say if you have to win a championship or make the Hall of Fame. I think if you are an integral part of a championship team, or you're part of the Hall of Fame, so Sidney Moncrief would get a statue, then you deserve a statue. So Giannis,
right.
Kareem, Big O, Bobby Dandridge,
four,
and Chris Middleton. I think Chris.
Five.
I say Chris because of how he played in that championship season when Giannis went down. And you could argue, I mean, people could argue Drew Holiday, but that to me is more on the right on the margins. Well,
so there's no minimum. So it's hard to do with Kareem and this and that, but like you should have been playing for the Bucks for at least a certain amount of years.
Well, remember that the franchise was only 4 or 5 years old at the time that they won that first championship. And it wasn't like the
franchise. Oh, really? Expansion?
Yeah, 1969, I think.
Oh, that's right.
Then they won a championship in 71. You know, they won a championship in 71. The franchise was established. So it wasn't like it was around all this greatness at the time where Oscar could have been here for 7, 8, 9 years.
That's real talk. Yeah. That's real talk,
so,
bro.
So, and I will say this. I mean, yeah, Wayne Embry. I mean, if you want to go executives, might warrant some conversation. But that's something that – I think social media, man, should give us a lot of great feedback on. You know, there's Chris Middleton. If the Bucks were to go that route, put some statues up in the Deer District, number one, should we do that? Number two, does Chris Middleton, Cash Money Middleton, all-time leader in three-pointers made, one of the all-time greatest clutch, and I say this without any cap whatsoever, Chris Middleton is one of the all-time greatest clutch performers that I've ever seen, Chris. He's right up there with Reggie Miller, and Michael, the great clutch shots, you know, not as big a stage as Michael in finals games and all that. But just, man, I've seen him make so
money
when it's released, you know, it's going in. We'll find a way to knock it down.
Question. Who have you been hanging around? You've been saying Cap a couple of times on the show. Who you been hanging around, man? Why are you saying Cap so
much? Well, you know, in our pre-production meeting, Mona said Cap a couple of times. It's about something. I kind of put it together in my head what it meant, you know. So
Mona uses Cap pretty liberally. I hear it about 100 times.
Yeah, Mona's Khan, one of our producers, uses Cap a lot. So I just decided to kind of, you know, intersperse it into my lexicon if I could. So anyway,
it's all good. It sounds cool.
All right. Well, listen, man. This next guest, after a brief timeout. No cap with him. Shea Serrano's coming back. Talk about his great book, Expensive Basketball. And can't wait to see what he's got to say and stick around so you can hear it. So, all right, man. Right around the corner, Shea Serrano.
All right. Welcome, everybody, here at District. Marcus Johnson, the captain of this vessel, as we continue the fantastic voyage heading into the beginnings of the NBA season. And I'm joined, as always, by my first mate, my son, Chris Johnson, who, by the way, we're the only father and son combination in the history of NCAA basketball to win a national championship at the same school. That's the caveat, at the same school. Chris, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Man, I'm doing good. Now, I got to set this up. So our guests, please bear with me. You know, when they first mentioned my guest, his name, you know, I was kind of like, you know, kind of off of it. Shea Serrano, okay. But when you do podcasts every week, you know, you got to find guests, and sometimes, you know, my guy Dylan Carter, our producer, he could go into
the best introduction I've ever gotten.
He could go down a rabbit hole a little bit. You know, we got to make this stuff work and all that. And I was like, okay, all right. Then they said, well, you know, that's Josiah's boy. So, you know, my son Josiah, they're like, Josiah, mm-hmm. Josiah and Shay, you know, they're cool, you know. So I reached out to Josiah. He started filling me in a little bit. And, of course, you know, doing my due diligence, I started to do my research. And all of a sudden, names like The Ringer and ESPN and Grantland and GQ and screenwriter. Now, I'm a writer myself, Shay. I'm just finishing a book. We'll talk about that later, The Crenshaw Chronicles. Okay. Chronicling all the great alumni of Crenshaw High School, Daryl Strawberry, Kevin Ollie, Big John Williams, Stevie Thompson, a bunch of people. But I'm reading all this, man, and then I see New York Times bestseller list. How many times, Shay Serrano?
Four times
on the New York Times bestseller list. I see, and this may have been the most impressive thing for me, I don't know why, but when I saw that you're on a list of Barack Obama's favorite books in 2017.
Yeah. How about that?
That's legendary. That's legendary.
You know? And so I started to have better feelings toward Dylan, our producer. but I'm really honored, man. Shay Serrano, New York Times bestselling author. Man, we appreciate you stopping by here, District, so much, man. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Oh,
I appreciate y'all having me on here. Again, that's the best introduction I've ever gotten.
And well deserved, because again, you know, the name didn't resonate right off the bat, but the more I looked into it, man, I just got excited. And then you coupled that with we're supposed to get like some copies of your book, I believe. So I just looked at the samples that were available on mm-hmm. Kindle, and just some of the stuff that you were writing about. I'm not sure if it was your new book or your old book. I think it was your new book where you talk about moments, Klay Thompson and Kobe Bryant's mm-hmm. last bit of basketball in his career, and Giannis's 50 piece in the final. That's the new book, right?
That's the new book, correct?
Yeah. So talk about the new book, the name of it. Expensive Basketball. Why that name? What it's about? And what was the motivation for you in terms of writing? Just writing in general, writing a basketball book, writing about pop culture as you do. Just give us the background. Just give us the whole spiel on Shay Serrano as a writer.
All right. Well, the book, as you mentioned, is called Expensive Basketball, and I felt compelled to write it because, as both of you know, the further along into basketball we've gotten, the more optimized everything has become. Like, everything gets measured in basketball. Every single thing you can think of, obviously points, rebounds, assists, that sort of thing, player efficiency rating, those sorts of things. But also they measure like how much salt is in a player's saliva so that they can optimize their sports drink. They measure how many times a player is the last person to cross half court. They measure how many times a player dribbles the ball. How many steps does a player take during it? They measure every single thing, right? And so it just felt a little like maybe what we need is the opposite of that. Maybe what we need is a book that there are stats in it, sure, but the stats are never the point of the book. Because my contention is that any great basketball moment you could think of, any single one, pick one, pick a Jordan shrugging after hitting the threes, or Vince Carter in the 2000 dunk contest, or anything you can think of at all. Nobody watched any of those moments and then was like, oh, wow, Michael Jordan is 6-for-12 from the field and his player efficiency rating is 22%, 22.9, whatever. Sure. Like, nobody thought any of that stuff. All that happens is you watch a thing happen on the court, an incredible, amazing thing, and your body fills with emotion. Oh my God, I can't believe what I'm seeing right now. The book is, you know, sort of designed to hopefully capture those feelings. Let's put those at the forefront. You can have the stats and the numbers in there, but it should be like in service of something. It should be to fortify something, not to serve as the like foundation of something. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And just to backtrack a little bit, man, because you brought up a great memory, and this is what we do on this show. We go back and tell stories and all that. But Vince Carter. And so Vince Carter, Shay, Chris, Gary Payton, I was going to say hired, but didn't pay me. So he asked me to MC his charity game in Seattle. This is in the 90s, whatever, that right before that dunk contest. And so Vince was a rookie coming in, I believe. Paul Pierce was there. A lot of great young players were there who hadn't really established themselves. And so after this All-Star game, so I was hired to MC. Now, I started MCing Chris, and I guess I was boring the pants off everybody because Mark Curry, the comic, Hanging with Mr. Cooper? Mark came over, like, give me that microphone. You don't know what you're doing. And so he took the microphone, and he was he was a natural at it. He was funny, had the whole 15,000 people at Key Arena in Seattle laughing. But after the game, yeah, Mark stole my thunder, Chris. But we always joke about that ever since. But so they had an impromptu dunk contest, Jay, after the game, after the All-Star game. And man, I'm watching Paul Pierce, Windmill, and some other guys do some solid stuff. But Vince started doing that reverse 360. He started doing all these crazy dunks. I'm blown away. So I'm working with Fox Sports, Kevin Frazier, at the time, studio show. And so we're getting ready to go into the dunk contest. And Kevin Frazier is poo-pooing the dunk contest. They need to get rid of it. There's nothing new out there. I said, man, trust me, Kay Frazier, this is on the air. I said, you're getting ready to see some dunks that you have never seen before in your life. He's like, come on, Marcus. I've seen every dunk there is. He's a ball player, wannabe ball player, Kevin Frazier. And after that dunk catch, he's like, man, the contest, he's like, man, you were right. I mean, those seminal moments, and I'd seen all those, the hanging in the rim and all that. Yeah. But, man, those seminal moments, man, just, and Chris and I digress even further, 1986, Dallas. Spud Webb.
Yeah. Reunion Arena.
Reunion Arena. We're sitting in, I'm an all-star. That's my final all-star game. I was 30 years old with the Clipper. The Clipper all-star, talk about an oxymoron. A Clipper all-star at that time was almost unheard of. But no, we're watching Spud Webb, man. Spud Webb.
5'7".
Do you remember that, Chris? vividly? Just, God. And so when I started reading your book, it brought me back to those moments, man. And I've seen it all. I've been there. I've done that. But still, there's a level of just excitement. I get sprung off that stuff, man. I get chills off that stuff. Even today, it connects me back to 86 and Vince Carter, the first time I saw him do that reverse windmill.
But, Shay, I think a lot of what your book captures from what I've read is just, it's like the reason why people fell in love with the game. You know what I'm saying? It's like you captured that emotion, that feeling. For instance, Giannis. Like, I wanted to ask you specifically about Giannis. Beyond the 50 points and all that, what was the expensive feeling, that particular just blend of will, skill, circumstance that made his Game 6 in 2021, like, an undeniable piece of work, piece of art?
Well, you look at how that finals sort of played out, right? The Bucks and the Suns are playing. The Suns go up 2-0, and you're like, this is over. Yeah. This is done. This is absolutely done. Your guy who in the Eastern Conference Finals, everybody thought broke his leg. Something is wrong with Giannis. He's not playing like he normally does. And then he shows up in Game 3, 42-12-4, and the Bucks win. And then he shows up in Game 4, 26-14-8, and then has this game-saving block at the rim. 2-2, all of a sudden, everybody in Phoenix starting to panic a little bit. Uh-oh, because they can feel it coming. Giannis is getting more and more powerful. Game 5, 32-9-6, with the game-saving and one alley-oop dunk. Yeah, like, he's just getting more and more powerful. And as somebody who's just watching impartially, I don't have any connection to the Bucks or to the Suns. I'm a San Antonio Spurs guy. But I'm just watching in, like, awe of what this guy's doing. And you're like, well, surely we've seen the best of it. And then he shows up in Game 6 with a 50-14-5 stat line. Not only that, but you look at how that game started. Like, it started with him just destroying everything immediately, just in the open court. Boom. As soon as he did that, like, oh, this is going to be a long night if you're a Phoenix fan. He's doing that. He's the free throw line story that comes into it of how he was just missing all of his free throws like crazy, and then now he's going to shoot 90% or whatever he shot for that game. It just felt special.
Wow.
It didn't even matter. Like, I mean, 50 points is like a cool thing to say. Like, that had never happened before in a closeout thing. Just like the way that you felt watching this guy decide we're not going to lose. And then I didn't even mention the whole thing of like, he could have left. He could have like started to dangle. I'm going to go. I'm going to leave. He didn't. He said, I'm going to stick around. I'm going to sign my extension. I'm going to win a championship here. And then he did exactly that. The whole thing, it just felt incredible to watch happen. You know, his father had passed. Yeah. Now we're seeing him on the sideline. I read this profile of him about in GQ where he talked about he's like this moment this moment to himself where he's just sitting there and it covers his face and he's like crying. And then in that moment, he said he was like talking to his dad, telling him that we did like this incredible thing. So all of this beautiful stuff all wrapped together. And it just felt like this needs to be coronated. Yeah. This needs to be celebrated some sort of way. How can I write a book about basketball feelings and not include this exact moment?
Yeah. And speaking of that game, I mean, so 50 points, 16 to 25 from the field, one of three three-pointers, which for Giannis, 33% is really, really good. We'll take that
crazy.
This season, 17 to 19 free throws, 14 rebounds, 6 blocks. I forgot. I mean, the 6 blocks.
He was everywhere.
But that stat didn't even register that he was that active at the defense. And it's the only time an NBA player in the history of the league has put together that kind of finals stat profile. You know, 50 rebounds, 6 blocks, the whole shebang. So, you know, for me, Shea, I don't care what you say. Whenever you do something, especially on that stage, whenever you do something nobody else has ever done, and I'm not talking about these made-up, fake, facade, fabricated stats. I'm talking about the real-deal stats that we look at, points, rebounds, assists, blocks, all that good stuff. I mean, God, I mean, you know, it's like you're dropped from outer space. You're like you're an alien, like you're a unicorn or whatever they call them nowadays.
Yeah.
That was just incredible. But let's talk about you. The other thing— The other thing that stood out to me, that gave you instant cred, man. That I felt like there was this kinship between us.
All right.
I would fly into Houston, Texas, to go visit my son in college. I drive down the highway, and I knew I was getting close when I saw this big white statue, this gigantic white statue.
Yeah.
On the right hand.
Sam Houston, baby. Sam Houston.
I knew we was getting close to Huntsville when I saw this big white Sam Houston, General Sam Houston. That thing, I don't know how big that thing is, but it's the biggest statue, Chris, off the side of the highway that you ever see in your life. It's all white marble or whatever it is, but it means you're about 10 minutes
Sam
outside of Huntsville.
It's Sam Houston?
It's Sam Houston. Sam Houston. General Sam Houston. Yeah. It's Sam Houston State. That's where Cyrus went to school, my son, for 4 years, was a redshirt freshman. COVID kind of got him all caught up, man. But so when I was in Huntsville, you ever been to the 1812 Steakhouse in Huntsville?
Mm-hmm.
1812. There's a couple of other good breakfast spots, man. But did writing? You met your wife in college, right? Am I correct?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Some good things happened from that. But when did you first decide on becoming a writer? I read a story about being a school teacher, middle school teacher and all that, but talk about the genesis of your writing career and how that first became a thought.
Yeah, so I was a middle school teacher. I taught science for 9 years. My wife was a middle school teacher as well. She taught social studies. I met her in college. We graduated. She's from Houston, so we moved we graduated. She wanted to be back in Houston, so I moved with her there, started working and that whole thing. But we're getting married. She's pregnant with twins, and like 4 months into the pregnancy, she went into labor while she was at work. And so it was like this, like a disaster of a situation. They rush her to the hospital. They do this emergency surgery. And then they tell her that, you know, for the rest of the pregnancy, for these final 4 or so months that you're going to be pregnant, you have to be on bed rest. You got to lay flat. Because if you get up, the babies are going to come out. And that's no good. And so she wasn't able to work anymore. And so all of a sudden we were about to be like a family of 4 on a teacher salary. I think my check at the time was maybe like $1,100 every 2 weeks, which is not near enough to like pay all of the bills. Together we could do it when we were both working, but just one of us working now, we couldn't afford the stuff. So I needed
a substitute teacher or something? $1,100?
No, I was a full-fledged teacher.
That's a full-fledged teacher salary?
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
What school district was it?
Where was that at?
It was in Houston ISD, so like one of the biggest in the country.
So go ahead. All right. Yeah, man.
And so I needed to make some extra money to like float us until she could go back to work. And I tried to apply at different restaurants and Walmarts and Target and all that. But each time I would get an interview, they would say, well, you can't work when we need you to work because you already have a full-time job. So I needed something I could do in my off time. I Googled work from home jobs and writer was one of them. And it said, you just need a computer and the internet if you want to try to be a writer. And I said, okay, well, I got both of those things. So I'll try that. And just start researching how to do that. You learn about like freelance writing. You learn how to pitch places. I start emailing every editor that I could get in contact with and just trying to talk somebody into letting me write for them. Eventually I was able to talk this woman who was doing a neighborhood newsletter. Like she was printing it up in her garage and then handing it out to her neighbors. And she paid me $15 to write about the Houston Texans. And then she paid me another $15 to write about the Houston Astros. So I did that.
That's 30.
I took that paper. I got my 30 bucks. I took that paper and then I went to the Houston Press, which is like the alt weekly in Houston, the next level up. And I'm like, hey, look, I'm a writer. Here's my proof. Here are my bylines. Let me write for y'all. And then they let me write for them. And then I took those ones. And then I was like, went to MTV. And I was like, hey, look, I wrote for the Houston Press. You should let me write for y'all. And they let me. And then I went to ESPN. And I was like, look, MTV let me write for them. You guys should let me write for you. And I just was like trying to build my way up like that. And then eventually made it onto this show, talking to the Johnson men.
And Chris Haynes, the great correspondent, NBA sideline reporter. Chris is all over the place. But he's got a similar story. Growing up in Fresno, I believe, but started out small time. And someone said moved to an NBA city, went to Portland, started writing newsletters on his own about the Blazers, got a press pass, press credential. And, man, I just love those stories of resiliency. I also love you got what I call the Frank Howard dynamic going on. And I love this. I'm kind of go off the path just a bit. But Frank Howard was this great baseball player, Shay, Chris, home run hitter, played for the Dodgers for a number of years, about 6'6", 250 pounds back in those days, but just crushed the ball type dude. Anyway, he wound up moving to Green Bay, Wisconsin, Shay. And so when they asked Frank Howard, this is what reminds me of you. They said, Frank, why Green Bay? He said, well, Green Bay has clean air, it's no crime, great schools, and that's where my wife is from.
Yeah, that's all you need. Where's my woman? Where my woman is.
It's not complicated at all. You also talked about
haters. One article I was reading about you, and you were talking about how, and I love this, and I know Chris can relate because he's got a lot of this in him. I've got a lot of this in me, but we can be petty sometimes. And you were talking about being petty, and just a lot of your success that propelled you was like you were trying to prove these naysayers didn't know what talk about that part of that dynamic in terms of moving up that ladder of success in terms of your career.
Yeah, I think you sort of try to take motivation from anywhere you can get it. And in my case, there were, you know, a number of people who I felt were saying I couldn't do a thing. And, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to let them be right? Or are you going to try to prove them wrong? That's really, really all that it was. But yeah, so this is my dumbest thing is, When I tried to do my first basketball book, Basketball and Other Things, I told some people about it, and there were four people who told me this is a terrible idea, nobody's going to buy this. And if somebody does, like a publisher does buy this, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I just like saved those emails because these were people who I'm like, you know, I worked alongside other writers like this sort of thing, and I saved those emails, and then I pitched the book and I sold it, and then it came out, and that was the first one I did that. Was number one on the bestseller list. And so when it got announced it was number one on the bestseller list, I took that and then I emailed it to them and I'm like, hey, remember this? And then now every single like time a good thing has happened, it's become like a joke at this point that I just will email those four people and be like, remember when you told me I couldn't? And yeah, that's all it is.
Wait a minute, man. Hold it. I got to get some insight here because I told you, I've completed a book. Now, I wrote the book with Charlie Rosen. I don't know if you're familiar with Charlie. He's written some books with Phil Jackson, a bunch of sports books. Different subject matter. Did one with Ray Scott, the first black coach in the NBA, the NBA in black and white. That's really good. That's how I got to know Charlie. So we wrote a book together about Crenshaw High School and kind of trying to put a finger on the Crenshaw mystique. Why is this Crenshaw name so iconic between Nipsey Hussle and the Marathon clothing brand and showing up in the TV show Brandy in the movie Boys in the Hood. Mm-hmm. But Charlie died. Charlie died like a month ago, man. He passed away. He'd been sick for a while. So I've been doing the heavy lifting for the last year, the interviews and transcribing and all that. Man, what's the key, man? What's the key? I know the material has to be right on point, but how do you help make that material right on point? And how do you – I'm not trying to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list, man. I'm just trying to get this bad boy published. I got a meeting tomorrow. I'm going to talk to somebody. But yeah. What for you, if you could give writers – aspiring writers, some advice on just, you know, in terms of what you found to be successful in terms of your approach to writing?
I think the general advice I try to give anybody who is working on something like this, be it an article or a book, are number one, you got to be writing about something that you care about, which obviously you are. You're done. That's a check. Because the reader can feel that.
Yeah.
Right. Like I've got a stack of books. All around. Here's a book. This is called Dream by Mirren Fader. And okay. Like I could tell when I was reading this book that she cares about Hakeem Olajuwon as like a figure in basketball and in the culture. And like I could feel it. Here's a Chris Herring's book, Blood in the Garden. You read this book and you could feel he loves the Knicks. He loves the Knicks. The macro phenomenal pro basketball Almanac by the Free Darko guys. Like you read this and you could feel they love basketball. They live with it. So you have that part. You're done there, right? You want to do that. Another thing that you want to do is you want to tell some stories that only you can tell, which you're obviously very good at. This is why you're doing that part here. And then like a good piece of writing advice that I got really early on was everything that you're writing, there needs to be like a point to it, a purpose to it, right? Why am I telling this particular story? Why am I talking about this particular thing? And every sentence that you write should help the reader arrive to that conclusion by the end of it. And if it doesn't, then you get it out of there. Even if it's a sentence you love, oh, this is such a cool phrase that I came up with right here. If it's not helping the reader get somewhere, then you got to get out of there. And then, you know, beyond that, you want to stay away from cliches. All of your favorite writers are writers who figured out a new way to say something. Charlie was great at this. This is why he made his name, because he was always going to have a thing in a piece where you're like, I've never heard it described that way before. I was reading a thing about Steve Nash one time years ago, and they described him in the offense as they were playing a team that was like packing everything in, and there's the writer described him as like a hummingbird inside of a sandwich bag, and I was like, that's such a cool, like, I get a picture in my head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you want to stay away from cliches. And if you do those sorts of things, you stay away from cliches, you write sentences that help a writer arrive at a point, you write about something you care about, and you're telling a thing that only you can tell, then the book will be good. And that's really all you can control.
Yeah. And so here's an example, and I want to get your opinion on this, and you chime in too, Chris. But so there's player that we wrote about who spent some time in prison. And this player, when I interviewed him on my own, he talked about how, you know, it wasn't that bad. He's from Crenshaw, knew a lot of people there. The head guard was his best friend's brother, hooked him up, and it wasn't that bad. So when I transcribed that interview, I left that in there. Charlie changed it around to, it was the worst experience of my life. When I asked Charlie, I was like, man, why'd you? Well, I don't think people want to hear that, you know, this guy goes to prison and it wasn't punitive. It was, you know. so, I mean, how much artistic licensing do you try and keep it as true to factual as possible? Or you tell me, you know where I'm going with this, but what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you keep it as factual as you can. Like, and so in this case, this guy explaining that prison wasn't that bad for him is immediately interesting to me. I want to know why it wasn't that bad.
Right.
What was in place? You're mentioning that the guard was right. The brother of his best friend. Like, that's how often does that happen? You know right. what I mean? That's right. very like. Tell me more about that. What other systems did you have in place that made it not the worst experience of your life? Because so many people have said this is the worst experience of my life. If you have a guy who's saying, "Hey, kind of wasn't that bad," immediately I'm curious about why that wasn't the case. Yeah. And then now that's what I want to read.
Well, and what's interesting too is that I spoke with Daryl Strawberry yesterday, and I've interviewed him a couple of times. And so, you know, he spent some time at the Gainesville Correctional Institute down in Florida, 11 months of an 18-month sentence for parole violations based on just problems with drug addiction. And Daryl was kind of the same way. I was like, man, you get tested with guys, you know, just trying to try you and all that. He's like, nah, Mark, you know, it was cool. I mean, everybody respected, you know, because of who I was, what I accomplished as a baseball right. player. And they just let me be me, you know, a couple of tense moments. But for the most part, it was, you know, it was just, so I always want to know what jail is like. Because, I couldn't hold up. I'd have been in my cot crying. Lord, please. Please, President Trump, commute my sentence, please.
Shay, I was curious about just creative risks. Since we're on this topic of like taking, you know, talking about, you know, this Charlie Rosen thing, do we leave it in? Do we leave it out? I'm curious about you in your works. If you took a creative risk that you were kind of unsure about, you know, before you did it, but later on down the road, it kind of paid off for you. Was there ever a moment you had during your writing some of your books?
Yeah, a bunch of them. Like you, again, if the pursuit is to try to write something that hasn't been written before, you got to take some chances, and you know, sometimes they don't work out, sometimes they do, but that's sort of, it's no different than if you're playing basketball, you're going to miss some shots, you get them, but you want to get them up there. And so if I try to think of a few, like obviously the Basketball and Other Things book, writing it the way that I did, where it's like, all right, in this book every chapter is going to be like a different type of basketball question that needs to be answered what we went into it there. It's like, okay, cool. But now we got to figure out, it would have been very easy to be like, okay, cool. Here are the chapters. Is LeBron better than Jordan? Was Magic better than Larry? Like, you can do that and people will buy that. And there's like a baked in sort of success because people are interested in that conversation. But what happens if you do like stuff that's not that, right? Now you're taking a slightly bigger risk because maybe people aren't going to be interested in it at all. Same thing with expensive basketball. Like there's a chapter in there about Michael Jordan, right? And we could have picked any number of like incredible Michael Jordan moments that made you feel something, anything, right? The game six layup steal jumper to end like his career with the Bulls, or his like, when he comes back with the Wizards and somehow is still incredible, or whatever, the dunk contest, you could have picked any of them. And then the thing that I ended up doing, which I thought was, which is like a very, like, I don't know if people are going to like it or hate it, but the chapter there is all about how there are so many like connections between him and the number six that you don't even like, the more that I researched, the more stuff started to pop up. Obviously, like he won six championships and he won six finals MVPs. Like those ones are easy, but also like his last name, Jordan, has six letters in it. His height, he's 6 foot six. Scottie Pippen's most famous teammate Michael Jordan's most famous teammate is Scottie Pippen. It's 33. 3 plus 3 is 6. Like there were just so many like Jordan's like devil. That.
So Jordan's
the Damien. Oh man. Ooh.
Jordan's the Antichrist.
Six, seven.
Like he scored 50 or more points 33 times in his career. 3 plus 3 is 6. Like it was just so much stuff like that. So I wrote that chapter and I was like, this is what I want like my Jordan chapter to be.
Oh boy.
Because I haven't seen that anywhere else, and like we'll see if people like it or they don't, but you know.
So you're saying that Jordan's like Joe Hardy and damn Yankees. There's a Mr. Applegate in his life where he's got to make his
Yeah, there's something.
Something's like going on.
There's crazy. So much stuff. Here's one. If you look at his final All-Star game, Marcus, you talked about your final All-Star game. We look at Jordan's final All-Star game. He was not selected as a starter. It was the only time. And when that happened, Allen Iverson and Tracy McGrady were both like, here, take my spot. You can have my spot. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. No, thank you. He turned him down. But eventually he did accept an offer to take somebody's starting spot. It was Vince Carter's, right? Mm. Not Allen Iverson, not Tracy McGrady. It was Vince Carter. Vince Carter's number, 15. 1 + 5, 6. Like those sorts of little things are, to me, really, it's like interesting to poke around. And I don't know. But again, you know, creatively, you're going to take some risks, and hopefully it works out. And if it does, great. And if it doesn't, well, then I'll try something again.
Great. That's good stuff. My favorite George story quickly. He's a rookie. I'm playing with the Clippers. Chris Shea, I set a flare screen at the elbow on him. He comes in with elbows high, Shea, and catches me with an elbow. I grabbed him. I was like, hey, rookie, watch the elbow. Check himself loose. Hey, vet, watch the screen. I was like, okay.
You know,
he wasn't taking crap right off the bat, man, from anybody. So anyway, go ahead, Chris.
I have a favorite Jordan story real quick. So me and MJ Shea, we're at the grand opening, like the premiere of Hidden Beach Records, which Jill Scott, I think you may be familiar with her. Mm-hmm. She kind of signed to him, but Michael Jordan was an investor. So we're at the party. MJ's there, Janet Jackson, Mike Tyson, everybody's there. Me and my dad are there as well. We see Mike. So we go over, we chop it up. I have a bunch of cigars and I'm just kind of, you know, hanging out, doing my thing, you know. I'm 20 something years old. I'm in college still. Not exactly the right look. Me and my dad roll up on him. I got my cigar. MJ, Jordan sees me. Takes the cigar out of my hand before he even says what's up. Puts it in his mouth. This is what I do. Then proceeds to light it and walk away. But he walked
That's
away.
Incredible.
It was the funniest. It was the craziest. I'm just sitting there looking like, what the heck just happened? My dad was just like, hey,
that's
man.
Incredible.
That's after summer playing at the Jordan. But Chris had played with him at the Jordan Dome all summer when they were shooting Space Jam out in L.A., and he would always pick Chris on his team because Chris could knock down mid-range jump shots, and Mike would always give him the ball. He was kind of like Chris's Paxson or Steve Kerr kind of character in these pickup games out there with Grant Hill and Lonzo Mourning and all these dudes.
That's crazy.
But anyway, man, listen. Let's,
crazy.
We go keep you all day. I want to talk about these Bucks this season. Your projection in terms of what they have done, the pieces they have brought in, they've gotten younger, they've gotten more athletic. Practices the last week before the season opens have been really, really chippy and spicy, and a lot of physical confrontations going on.
A lot of barking
going on. But where do you see the Bucks? Everybody's picking the Bucks. I don't think I've seen them higher than fifth and play in. But where do you see this iteration of the Bucks finishing?
I mean, you busted up.
That feels pretty accurate. Somewhere between fifth and play in. I think I was doing an interview maybe like 2 or 3 days ago, and they asked me the storylines I was most interested in for this season. And the Bucks are one of them, because obviously the Giannis thing, I think we're a year away from it being like a real conversation of, is he going to be gone? I think he's here all season, right? I don't think he should leave. I think he should stick around forever. He feels like be Dirk Nowitzki. You know what I mean? Be a beloved, even if it's just one championship, like that's a championship. You're good. You're solid. You're solidified for the rest of your career. You're fine. Don't leave, Giannis. But yeah, it's a younger team. They are, as you mentioned, gaining a reputation pretty quickly for being like kind of mean, which I like, because this is what we saw from Giannis when they won the title, was he turned into mean Giannis, and all of a sudden he became unstoppable. I'm curious how many more brothers they're going to bring in to put on the roster to try to like, I don't know why they keep finding these Antetokounmpos. Like, but yeah, I mean, like, I'm excited about it. I'm curious to ask y'all how y'all feel about Kyle Kuzma, because that's a very polarizing player.
Well, polarizing. I get it. I mean, I think what's going to happen, and Chris and I have gone back and forth on this, and Chris turned out to be more right than I was on this, at least for the start of the season. It looks like Kyle's going to come off the bench. And I didn't like that only because of Kyle's mindset, his mental state, how that would impact him. But what I've watched in the exhibition season, Shea, is that when Kyle is matched up against second unit fours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fours coming off the bench playing against. Now he's got an advantage, and he's been looking like he has an advantage, and playing like he feels like he has an advantage, playing with confidence, and getting downhill and pushing it up and playmaking. And the other point, and then Chris, you can jump in. You know, Giannis is going to play 34, 35 minutes, which means you've got about 14, 15 minutes that the Bucks were getting crushed the past couple of seasons with Giannis off the floor. Now in Kyle Kuzma, Taurean Prince, Bobby Portis, the second unit. Cole Anthony has looked great. Ryan Rollins, this second unit
like
right
Anthony.
Now. Man, this second unit, man, right now, they've been crushing the first unit in practice. But they look really good, like they're going to be able to either at least hold the fort or maybe, you know, increase the advantage when Giannis is off the court. So I like Kyle. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I think that's a good thing as far as the second unit giving the first unit a hard time, because I'm not sure if it was like that last year, but, you know, this year iron sharpens iron. I guess my point about Kuz, we talked to his trainer, Clint Parks, and, you know, we got some insight on Kuz's mindset. He sort of has a renewed mindset. He understands last year was unacceptable. He understands that he wasn't in the right type of conditioning to do what was asked of him. And so he spent this entire summer really locking in, Shay, and getting back to what made Kyle Kuzma originally. Getting back to the glass, making the winning plays, the hustle plays, and also understanding the shot diet needs to be refined. So I think he's worked on that. I think he's coming into the season with the right type of mindset. Like, he has a focus. He understands his role off top. Like, Doc and him, everybody's locked in on the same page. Doesn't matter if he starts. Doesn't matter if he plays the three, the four, whatever.
Yeah.
He's just locked in to help the Bucks win. I think that's where he's at with it.
Yeah, and to add one more point, Miles Turner, Shay, has one of the highest IQs of a basketball player that I've seen in a while. And I say that in the context of him knowing exactly when to sacrifice himself, when to make that delayed cut to draw a couple of defenders or open up a corner three. I mean, Eric Name of The Athletic pointed it out video-wise when he was reviewing one of the games. But Miles Turner's cerebral approach to basketball. I interviewed him after the game. He talked about, I said, the biggest adjustment playing with Giannis. Well, I gotta adjust my shot profile. You know, I had to go look up, like, what the hell? But that's his approach. I mean, and I'm just being facetious with that. But he knows he's got to change certain elements of his game, and he's got to give himself up, and Giannis even mentioned that. He sacrifices himself so everybody else can get open shots. That kind of mindset, man, goes a long way in terms of chemistry and team success.
No, it's really rare to have a big that size with that type of mobility and athleticism, that cerebral, meaning, you know, Turner does a bunch of stuff offensively, like that's not like direct action stuff. He's doing stuff off ball. He's doing stuff to get guys open. He understands spacing. He's like constantly in a state of like motion and doing stuff to put himself or somebody on his squad in a better position. So that's kind of, you know, it's great that we got a guy that's younger than Brooke, but also a guy that has similar skill set, but also a motor offensively that Brooke just didn't have anymore.
And thinking ahead of the play, staying ahead of the play, wherever the play is, I'm thinking, I'm in like, you know, I'm a half a play ahead of this action that's taking place. And that's a good thing. But go ahead, Shay.
Yeah, I was really surprised when he got out of Indy. It didn't make any sense to me, like, why you, number one, why you let him go. Number two, why you let him go to the Bucks, who,
of all teams,
like, right. You know, like of all the teams, I remember for so many years, there was like an unspoken thing in San Antonio where they were just like, we're not going to do any trades with the Lakers. Cause the Lakers, you know what I mean? Like, we're just not going to do it. And it's like, I thought it was the same thing. And then you see he ends up there. Which is crazy. I do want to say two things, because I keep trying to work them in there and I haven't figured out a way for like a cool segue to do that, but it hasn't presented itself. So I'm just going to jam it in here now. Two things. Number one, when I was in middle school, I'm 44 years old, right? So middle school is like the mid 90s. And that's when UCLA was like UCLA, you know what I mean? And so I don't know anything about college basketball, but in middle school at Ronald McNair Middle School in San Antonio, Texas, UCLA was the most popular basketball team outside of the Spurs. For some reason, I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was, but it was like, you remember you had the JanSport backpacks and they had like a leather, like a leather suede thing on the bottom. People would just draw UCLA on there. Like that was a thing that you that you did. So when I saw I was doing the show, I was like, I got to make sure I mention this because this is there's my first one. Oh, go ahead.
No, real quick tidbit because I can't let you go. You went to Ronald E. McNair Middle School. So did I in Atlanta, Georgia. Ronald,
that's crazy.
One of the astronauts.
Yeah,
one of the astronauts that passed away on the Challenger explosion. I went to the same name middle school, except one in Atlanta, Shay. That's why I had to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad I didn't say quarterback. But go ahead. So what was the other thing?
The other thing was we have this like this wall of movies behind me. I'm going to grab this front-facing one right here. Come on. You see what this is here?
The greatest
sports movie ever made. The greatest sports movie ever made. The greatest, basketball movie. No, not up there. It is. What's a better movie than White
Hoosiers?
Man Can't Jump?
Better than Hoosiers, Shay?
Much better than Hoosiers.
Better
Are you kidding
Hoosiers?
Me?
I'll take it. Come on, Norman Dale.
Let me poke a hole in Hoosiers. The easiest possible hole to poke. The whole Hoosiers movie, Gene Hackman is like, pass the ball, team ball. When the game was on the line, the championship is on the line, he runs an ISO. He's like, get my guy the ball. Everybody get out of the way. No more team ball. No more anything. He holds the ball for 20 seconds and then shoots a contested pull-up two, the worst shot in basketball. No, yeah, Hoosiers is not better than White Men Can't Jump.
Didn't he run that play for the other kid first, and then everybody kind of looks at him like, Coach, what? Then he's like, what's wrong? You know, then they're like, you know, and that's when Jimmy says, I'll make it, you know. And then he draws up that ISO for Jimmy Chitwood.
Crazy.
But
just abandoned all of his principles immediately.
Speaking of which, this is the final topic we promise here, but we're talking about basketball movies. You said White Men Can't Jump. Give me your Mount Rushmore. Of basketball movies.
All right, here we go. Mount Rushmore of basketball movies. White Man Can't Jump. Obvious, easy. The number one again. The number
Why
one.
Why do you like White
movie.
Man Can't Jump? Why do you like White Man Can't Jump so much? What is it about White Man Can't Jump that just resonates with you like it does?
Okay, so the basketball player who made me fall in love with basketball was Reggie Miller, right?
Got it.
Just a trash talking, fearless underdog of a player. I'm 12, 13, 14 years old the first time I see White Man Can't Jump. And the whole movie is them just – it's the two coolest guys you ever saw, Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson, talking S the whole time to everybody, against themselves included. I had never seen a movie where – it was always like you get to the end and the guy gets the girl and that's the like main story. But in this one, you get to the end and you realize this is not a story about – Woody Harrelson and Rosie Perez. This is a story about Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes, which I thought was just incredible. Like two who are going to be longtime best friends, whatever. The thing of them going around hustling everybody, the betrayal. It was just like, it was all stuff that as a 13-year-old kid in San Antonio, I had never seen before. And I just thought it was so cool. And then you get older and you realize like how smart it is with regard to how it deals with race and all of the like the nuance in the script and the way that shot. It's a beautiful, perfect movie. But that, so
how,
there you go.
How brothers just want to look good, don't care about it. Yeah.
People are still having that conversation. Rod Shelton's still happening.
Rod Shelton was definitely prophetic with that one. But go ahead, man. Okay. White Men Can't Jump.
White Men Can't Jump is on there. I think Above the Rim. You got to have Above the Rim on there. Yeah. Right? Give me Leon. Lighten up Rucker Park in corduroy pants.
Yeah.
Give me, you know what I mean? Just stepping into the game. No jersey, no shorts, no nothing. Just corduroy pants in a turtleneck or whatever
college,
it was.
Former college ball player. He played college ball or something. I think Leon is a legit ball player. Go ahead.
He's incredible. He scores 40 points in 3 minutes. And you're like, it's the greatest thing I've ever
seen. The most ridiculous 40 you'll ever see.
ever. No fouls, no nothing. Just get out there and fight. All right. White Man Can't Jump, Above the Rim.
Who else?
Give me Love and Basketball. Love and Basketball. Right. That final game when they play one-on-one and you think it's going to go one way And then he dunks on her. Quincy dunks on her. It's like, right? With the Michelle song playing in the background, it's just beautiful. Also written and directed by a former like college player. Like she knew. We were talking earlier about tell the story only you could tell. Only Gina could have written and directed that movie that way because she knew exactly what all the pieces were. All right.
One thing about Loving Basketball.
Loving Basketball. Give me one thing.
College player, Crenshaw High School again. You Clippers. Mm-hmm. A lot of my homies were like, "Man, did you get any money from that?" I was like, "No, that's you and Chris's story." And then Gina was actually at UCLA, right, Chris, when you were there. So I mean, and she gives the inspiration.
Yeah, she goes in other directions. I think you read for it, and yeah. I read for a part. You read for a part as well. Yeah. So we had an early look at the script. It was a lot of similarities, but at the time, I didn't think nothing of it.
Yeah, I didn't either until all my you know, a bunch of guys were like, "Man, you guys should have got a cut of that whatever money was made." But anyway, so Gina, but she did a tremendous job. Great writer, great director. Gina Blythewood Prince. Let me. Her name mm-hmm. right, but go ahead. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's Love and Bats and I Late Them. Man, yeah, man.
She's incredible. Yeah, she's incredible.
Yeah. Omar Epps. Yeah, yeah.
Watching that movie, I thought she had like played basketball before, and then I read a bunch of interviews, and she said she never touched a basketball until that movie. Like she learned all of that stuff.
So I'll tell you, Shay. So for the whole. Like up leading up to the movie, she was working out in the men's gym at UCLA. She had a personal trainer. I believe it was a guy that was an assistant coach in the NBA, but we would see her every morning, kind of learning the game from the ground up, being taught the fundamentals, how to dribble, how to shoot, how to run. Like they would be on the side court at the UCLA men's gym. So that's just a little tidbit about her part.
Okay. So we got White Man Can't Jump Above the Rim, mm-hmm. Loving Basketball. We got
one spot left, and there's about 15 movies that could go there. I'm not counting Hoop Dreams because that's a documentary.
Right.
That's a whole separate. That's a whole separate thing. That's a work of art, by the way.
One of my favorite. Arthur Agee and you know the whole crew.
Yeah, William Gates.
William Gates and his the older brother. What's the older brother's name that used to be?
Curtis.
Curtis. and then the Arthur's buddy that worked with him in the pizza place.
Oh, I forgot.
Shannon.
Yeah.
Yeah, but go ahead.
There are so many others that we can pick from you. Blue Chips, Coach Carter, Hustle, which is really good. I mean, Semi-Pro if we want a funny movie in there. Yeah. But for that last spot, you know who I need? You know who I want in there? Who I got to have every single time? Bro. I got to have him. I got to have the greatest actor who has ever lived. Denzel Washington, directed by Spike Lee.
Okay.
Opposite Ray Allen, Rosario Dawson, Rick
Jesus
Fox.
Jesus Shuttlesworth.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That's a perfect basketball movie. I love the story. Dope. I was listening to, I think Spike was on the Bill Simmons podcast, and he was talking about originally the script called for like when Denzel and Ray Allen play their final game, Ray Allen's supposed to like beat them 11-0 or whatever, but that Denzel scored on accident. Like he genuinely scored.
Yeah.
Those first four shots or whatever he hits, Ray was trying to stop him and he was so confused what's going on. But that's all Denzel just being a movie star in the moment, talking trash. I'm going to take an extra lap. That's my favorite actor of all time. I think he's the greatest actor who's ever lived.
Yeah. But here's our Denzel story.
You got a Denzel story?
I got one too, Dan.
Well, I want to hear both of them.
This may be the same story. So Chris is all of 14 years old. I'm taking him up to the Hollywood YMCA at noontime. They got a nice little noontime run. Probably how old? What year was that, Chris? 14? Midnight?
'89, '90.
So Denzel is there, and Denzel played at Mount Vernon High School with Gus Williams and Ray Williams and Earl Tatum and that whole group. Denzel played at Fordham, coached by P.J. Carlesimo, coaches JV team at Fordham University when he played JV ball there. So Denzel, you know, he fancies himself as a legitimate ball player, and I got no qualms with that. He's cool. So, but him and Chris, Jay, Chris is this uber-strong post-up player. So him and Denzel are going at each other. They're going at each other, bumping and banging. And all of a sudden, Denzel squares up with him. It's like, I'll kick your young ass. It's a little MF-er. I'm going to send you home to your mama. And I was like, and I think he knew who he was. So I come up behind Denzel. I was like, he ain't got to go home to his mama. His daddy's right here. He's like, oh, all right, Marcus. All right. Well, listen, well, tell him to lighten up on them elbows or whatever. Anyway, so kind of, you know, it decelerated. But Chris and Denzel Washington were by. Chris wasn't backing down. Chris was about to whip Kobe Bryant's behind Kobe's first month out in L.A. when he first came out here as a high schooler. So Chris wasn't backing down. To Denzel, and I had to defuse the situation to get Denzel. And we still laugh about it today. Remember, you was about to kick Chris's ass up at the Hollywood Y when he was like 14 years old.
But the funny thing about it was he, you know, it was probably because he was scoring on me or doing what I didn't think he should do, which is probably bust my ass, right? So I'm like, man, I got frustrated and I had a moment. But fast forward now, Shay. The year is 2000. It's the NBA Western Conference Finals, Lakers versus Blazers. I ended up going to the game. My old college coach, Steve Lavin, right? He gives me a call. He's like, hey, you want to go to the playoff game? I'm like, heck yeah. He's like, I got three tickets. Okay, I'm like, cool. So it's me, Lav, and his buddy. So we get to the arena, and we get the tickets, right? So Lav's got three tickets. Two of them are kind of like, two rows above courtside. He's got a single that's a courtside seat. So he's like, he calls me Stani. He's like, Stani, take the courtside. So I'm like, okay, you know, and I'm just chilling, dude. I take the ticket. I go down to courtside. I'm kind of looking around. I see, you know, who, and lo and behold, who do I pull up on? First person, Denzel and his wife.
That's
so
crazy.
My seat is next to Denzel and his wife. Denzel, his wife's on the other side. I take my seat. We kind of dapping up, you know, talking, laughing. And stuff. hey, and then all of a sudden, Shay, I look to my right, and it's lo and behold, it's Salma Hayek and Edward Norton.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, Edward Norton. So I'm sandwiched between Denzel and his wife and Salma Hayek. Literally, for the greatest playoff game I'd ever seen, but it was also one of the biggest moments of cheating that I felt like I've ever seen with my own two eyes. I don't know if you remember that game, Shay, but the Lakers were down 15, made this crazy comeback, but literally I'm watching Scottie Pippen hack. I mean, like, I'm watching people hack Scottie. They're beating up Steve Smith. They're beating up Rasheed. No call. Wow. Ref swallowing. That's the one that Kobe threw the lob to Shaq, and then Shaq went crazy and all that.
Yeah.
So that's my Denzel story.
Oh, man. Some good stuff.
Man.
That's a crazy,
Only in L.A., man. That's L.A., man. That's L.A. for
you. L.A.
It's not San Antonio, man. That's L.A. That's how we do it.
No, for real. You go to a basketball game, you're sitting next to He Got Game, Desperado, and American History X. Like, that's nuts.
That was crazy.
And I go back to the Hemisphere Arena with the Baseline Bums. See, that's Chris.
Now we're talking.
That's the starting lineup. They turn it back on you. Read a newspaper. Who cares? So what? But listen, man.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Chase, the Baseline Bums, Hemisphere Arena. Chase Serrano.
It was great.
Man, I appreciate you stopping by to hear District Man. Continued success. I can't wait to get my copy of this book, Expensive Basketball.
Thank
It'll be
you.
Out right around the time we're going to release this pod on October 28th. And continued success. Hopefully this will be New York Times bestseller number 5. If it isn't already, did you get
no doubt. No doubt.
You get pre-sales already to bestseller list, or you got to wait to
wait
for the actual count?
You got to wait for the actual count. Can I do one last thing before we get out of here?
How many last things you want to do, you do, bro. But quick question. Do we count Cooley High and Basketball Diaries as basketball movies? Cornbread Earl and Me? I don't know.
Basketball Diaries, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, Cooley High, Cochise with that bogus jump shot.
I don't think you can count that one as a basketball movie.
That's, yeah. All right. Just curious. But go ahead.
You mentioned Sam Houston. I'm gonna tell you one basketball story from Sam Houston.
Okay.
Because I don't know if you went up there, you saw this or was the same way. But when I was there, they had the Kinesiology Center, which is where the basketball courts were. The gym was like, that's where you go play. And there were four courts inside, indoor courts, all next to each other. Boom, 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 boom. And it was like, the worst players were on the far left. And then as you made your way across the courts, the best players were on the far right. So the far right was like the actual college team that was playing Yeah. They were like out there just, you know, between practices or in the off season. Yeah. That's where they would go and play. Only on that court, all the worst players on the other side. And so I got there and they explain this to you as though this is like a rule in jail. Like you start here and then if you win, you can like work your way across. So I started playing on the terrible court and I did okay. And I was like slowly making my way toward the college court. And I never was like able to get invited to the court until one day, like apparently somebody who was supposed to show up didn't show up and they needed a player. And so they asked me, I was on the next court. They say, we need a guy. You're just sitting here waiting. You want to play? And I said, okay, this seems like a horrible idea because all of you guys are 6'2" and above. I'm 5'7", but I'll go out there and I'll give it a try. And I'm going out there and I'm trying to do my best, like Reggie Miller talking trash impression. And the game starts and they kick it out to me and I shoot it and it lucks its way in. Boom. A three. I'm not going in the paint. Are you crazy? Yeah. I go. They pass me the ball. I throw it up there. It drops in. And now you can't tell me nothing. I'm playing against college players. I hit my first shot. You can't tell me nothing. As I'm going around, down the court, I'm running my mouth now. I'm letting them know. You ain't never seen a Mexican on the court like me. Like I'm doing this whole thing, right? I'm letting them hear it. And literally as I'm talking, I turn around. And there was a guy. His name was Felton Freeman. Right? Okay. He's like 6'5", 6'6", or whatever.
Yeah.
I turn around and he is charging at me full speed. And I'm like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I just stand there and he jumps. I felt like he jumped from half court. Couldn't have been half court, but it felt like that. And he jumped and he just kept going up and up and up and up and up. And all of a sudden, I'm like under the rim and he's boom, like a big, loud. I fall backwards like Chris Dudley or whatever. And I was like, this is why I don't want to play with you. And playing against college basketball players it's like another planet that you're on. It's not
but
the
you
same.
Got buckets. Yeah, but you got
I got
buckets.
One. I got one bucket. And then I was like, I quit. I'm at it. I didn't even finish the game. I was like, screw you guys. I'm going home. Because they're just laughing.
Okay, so I got to end with a couple of stories. The first one, you reminded me, we talked about the Mexican basketball player. So I'm coaching the Belize national team 2010, same year John Wooden died, down in Belize, down there 2 months, training camp, the whole deal, first chance to really coach on that level, playing in an Olympic qualifying event for teams in Central America. So we're playing this team from Mexico, and they're kicking our butt. I got NBA guys, the former NBA guys, Mil Palacio, some other guys that had a cup of coffee in the NBA. And so at halftime, I'm like, you guys are letting a bunch of Mexicans kick your behind like that?
Wow! Wow!
I said, you're getting your butts kicked by a bunch of Mexicans. Mexicans say, hey, Palacio, ain't told me I'll play. You guys are from L.A. and Compton and all this bull crap, and these Mexicans. But it turns out that one of the Mexicans was a kid by the name of Gustavo Ayan, who was actually on the New Orleans Hornets roster that next season. He was 6'9". He was killing. But I didn't know. He was killing it. And then the other quick story, Reggie Miller. You talk about Reggie Miller. So Reggie Miller, Chris, he's an incoming freshman. Nobody really seen him. We didn't have the social media and all the stuff that they have today. But here's this skinny kid with this big head. But he was really skinny back then. And so nobody would pick him on their team, you know, the first couple of runs. Just a bunch of just pros and NBA established vets out there. And so finally somebody tells me, like, that's Reggie Miller. You know, that's Cheryl's brother. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, he's coming here, right? Yeah, okay. So I go up to him. I say, man, what's your name, man? He's like, I'm Reggie Miller. I said, oh, right. I said, now, are you any good? He's like, yeah. I said, are you better than your sister? He's like, yeah. I said, no, I'm just messing with you. I got you on my team next. I got you. And he went out there. Are you better than your sister? He's like,
that's cold, man. He's like, that's cold-blooded.
Yeah. I'm a lot better. I was like, okay, I got you. I'm just messing with you. But he went out there and turned it out, man. You could see right away his toughness, his shooting,
that's awesome.
His knack for the game. You just knew he was going to be a great, great player. So anyway, man, listen, Shay, we're going to let you go, man. Appreciate you coming by here, District. Please come back during the course of the season. We love having you. And again, much success on the new book coming out, Expensive Basketball, right, is the title of it.
Correct.
And, man, we'll be looking forward and want to see it on that New York Times bestseller list. So, Shay Serrano.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. Here, District. Thank you. Shay Serrano.